Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Mark Fulman is a longtime journalist and the national affairs editor for Mother Jones. Since 2012, his various investigations into gun violence and its impact on American society have been honored with numerous awards. His writing and commentary have been featured in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and on National Public Radio, among other media. Mark's new book is Trigger Points: Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Follow him on Twitter at Mark Fulman. Coming up, we'll talk about which warning signs to look for, how to keep bias out of the threat assessment process, and how to know when it's the right time to intervene.
So when you see your son, who is in all other ways, as far as you know, behaving normally or appearing to be a healthy individual, the fact that he is looking at guns on YouTube tells you nothing concerning. I mean, that's normal behavior for a teen boy, right? I have a young son too, who likes to play battle and pretend shooting guns. And I did that when I was a kid too. So the question is, how do you distinguish when you're starting to see worrisome behaviors?
But first, Mark, how big is the problem of mass shootings in America?
Well, it's a question that is debated quite a lot these days because there's different ideas of what defines a mass shooting. In the context of the work that I've done over the past decade to study the problem, I've used a pretty conservative criteria to define the problem, to really focus in on these kinds of attacks that are very high profile and very traumatic and costly in the communities where they happen, the Sandy Hooks and Parklands, going back further to Columbine, the movie theater shooting in Aurora. So by that definition, it's a smaller set of attacks. There are broader databases now that talk about a much larger number of mass shootings annually in the United States. You know, I've kind of left behind at this point the discussion of frequency and total number of attacks because there isn't really any one clear answer. From my perspective, we have a lot of them, no matter how you describe the problem. I think most people would agree we have way too many of them. So that's really, you know, what has driven my focus on this subject and asking the fundamental question, what more can we do as a society to deal with this and try to reduce this problem?
Do you define a mass shooting as more than four victims? I mean, is there a threshold that you use?
Yeah, so historically, that was kind of a loose consensus. When I first started looking into this 10 years ago, I built really the first of its kind online database of mass shootings for Mother Jones in my work there. And at the time, looking into how it was defined, I found some sort of loose consensus among criminologists studying the problem and at the FBI and some research discussions that a mass shooting was defined by an attack in which four or more victims were killed. Really just an arbitrary baseline. I mean, why isn't it five or seven or three, right? Mm-hmm. But that was what people were using at the time. Since then, the wider criteria that I was describing a moment ago has been defined as shootings in which four or more people are either injured or killed. So you can imagine that's a whole lot more cases, right? The other sort of basics of the original criteria that I used had found in that research was an attack in a public place, seemingly indiscriminate, or as I came to describe it in my research work, looking at cases where the motive wasn't easily defined in any kind of conventional sense, like a robbery or a fight between rival gangs or something like that, where you can look at an attack and say, oh, we know what this is, but rather to try again to focus on what is it that causes a person to walk into a movie theater and shoot 70 people that happened that year in 2012.
Right. And another thing you make a reference to is just how many of these shootings, these arbitrary shootings, have been stopped by the FBI and other authorities. For one mass shooting, how many are stopped?
So it's another kind of fascinating question and one that has definitional challenges in this subject matter, right? So Trigger Points focuses on this field called behavioral threat assessment, which is this prevention method for intervening with people who are thought to be planning violence and cases in which there's evidence of that planning and other kinds of warning behaviors and warning signs that lead experts to think they need to intervene. So through the course of that work, you can look at quite a few cases. I looked at many cases in the course of doing the book in schools and workplaces and other settings where you had a troubling individual acting in disruptive ways and concerning ways, with some evidence of them potentially planning to commit violence, and then having intervention, which primarily is intended to be constructive through this method, meaning you're trying to help people essentially who need help rather than just try to lock them up or fire them from their job. Because historically, the field's research shows that that isn't very effective, the latter, to just try to kick someone out the door or maybe jail them for a period of time if they're acting in really in criminal ways legitimately, but they're going to come back in a lot of cases. And so what the field learned through case research over decades was, well, we need a better way to address the root causes of the problems here with people who may be turning dangerous in this way. So looking at cases where that's happened, one can estimate that there have been dozens of mass shootings stopped, perhaps hundreds throughout the country over the years using this approach, because you're talking about people who were in serious crisis or deeply enraged and developing ideas of committing a violent attack and then taking steps to carry it out. The method of threat assessment really looks at that process. That is the approach to stopping these cases, is to look at what kinds of patterns, behaviors, and circumstances lead up to a mass shooting. And if we know more about that, then we have information we can use to intervene.
You mentioned some of the warning signs just now. Are there other warning signs? It seems like you break them down into 8 categories.
Yeah, and they're kind of broad categories. So some of them speak to people's mental or behavioral health, and others are more circumstantial to their life situation, right? The most sort of obvious warning sign that tends to come late in the process is attack planning and preparation, as I was alluding to. Someone acquires a gun and is thinking about where they're going to go commit one of these attacks and has maybe written that down or talked about it to someone else. That's another area of warning sign that's common in these cases, threatening communications. The field has a term for it called leakage, which refers to how a would-be shooter might be signaling to someone around them that they're thinking about doing this. Sometimes that's through direct statements of threatening behavior, or sometimes it's more veiled language. Sometimes it's in drawings or internet usage. We see that a lot in school shootings, right? Including the most recent high profile case in Michigan and at Oxford High School last fall, where that offender was making drawings in class the morning of the shooting of violence and with comments of despair and rage on the page. Those are the kinds of warning signs that people trained in threat assessment would be looking for. And then there are other things more broadly in a case subject's life that can be important. Signs of personal deterioration, like dropping out of class, quitting a job, sudden changes in routine that are negative that show a person kind of spiraling into crisis. And signs of suicidality are very important. Many mass shootings are murder suicides. And that was one of the first findings, one of the sort of first major findings I had with my database work starting a decade ago, was learning that more than half of mass shootings end in suicide. That's a very important factor among many in these cases in terms of warning signs.
How do you know when to intervene, though, when you start seeing these warning signs? Because it seems like we miss a lot of them. We go, oh gosh, if only we had connected the dots. For example, sometimes my son, who's 13, I mean, he'll make some drawings or like watching gun videos on YouTube. And I'm thinking to myself, is there something that I should or could be doing here? And at the same time, I might worry about teachers seeing like maybe a drawing at some point going, uh-oh, you know, he's a potential threat. So when do you step in and when do you not?
Yeah, it's a great question. And that's really a fundamental challenge with this work. And I think also what the promise of the work is, from what I've seen in all of my study of it, is that it brings together collaborative expertise to evaluate people who may be raising concerns. So when you see your son, who is in all other ways, as far as you know, behaving normally or appearing to be a healthy individual, the fact that he is looking at guns on YouTube tells you nothing concerning. I mean, that's normal behavior for a teen boy, right? I have a young son too, who likes to play battle and pretend shooting guns. And I did that when I was a kid too. So the question is, how do you distinguish when you're starting to see worrisome behaviors. And the collaborative approach of the field, I think, is quite fascinating in that respect. Threat assessment teams bring together people with expertise in mental health, also in law enforcement, in a school setting, obviously education as well. You have administrators and school counselors who serve on a threat assessment team. In a workplace setting, you would have people with HR expertise, people who know people, right, and who deal with people problems and behavioral problems. And then bringing that group of people together, training them in the protocols of this method, and then relying on that collective judgment, because some of it is judgment calls. The answer to your question also lies in the approach of the field. As I said earlier, this is preventative and it's constructive, right? So the notion of intervening, or when do you intervene, comes down to, well, if somebody seems to be struggling or needs help, that's how you're starting to intervene. And, you know, leaders in the field have said to me many times in interviews that they'll be the first to say, well, hindsight is 20/20, right? It's always easier to see the warning signs after an attack. But what they'll say also is that really the ultimate ideal of this mission is early intervention. It's helping people early on when they're struggling. And by doing that, you're getting in the way of even the prospect that they might start to plan violence, because you've already noticed something is going wrong. A process of gathering information around the person if others are feeling uncomfortable, but then also going to the subject and saying, hey, you know, we're worried about you. What's going on? Can we help you? And you can imagine how that can be very effective in a school setting, which is highly structured and has a lot of resources for that already.
I'm just trying to imagine how to implement something like that on a broader scale. I mean, would you say that we as a country have the resources now, or is there some sort of policy change that needs to happen on a national level and a state level to create these supports, which sound extremely effective when they're used?
Yeah, so that's a question I asked a lot in the course of my reporting for the book. And I think the most optimistic answer that I would tend to get from threat assessment leaders is that a lot of this is already built in to our society, to our systems. So in a school district, you have people who do counseling work, who, you know, you have school psychologists, you have people in charge of safety and administrators, that's part of their role. So it's really a matter of them becoming trained in this method, right? And doing the work with a kind of systematic approach. So that's probably, in my view, where the investment would need to be more of, would be in the funding, the training. Because in some ways, this is still a very little known field of work, which is also quite interesting because it's been around for 40 years. It was developed in the 1980s. Interesting discovery for me in digging into this subject, threat assessment came out of collaboration between mental health professionals and federal law enforcement agents in the Secret Service. It was originally developed as a way to try to prevent assassinations by figuring out what's the behavioral process that leads up to assassination. Can we predict it? And if we can't, you know, how can we notice it coming through behaviors, right? That's the concept. And it was eventually adapted for schools in the era after Columbine. But I think that it is possible that we could have it much more broadly in the country, potentially to great effect.
How do we keep bias out of it? Because we do have so much implicit bias. And how do we avoid profiling, for example, because there are so many negative stereotypes that are floating around?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's also why the training is so important in terms of what I've seen with this work, because there are a bunch of big myths about mass shooters. One of them is that they can be profiled, or that there is a profile. So most people tend to think, oh, this is angry young white males, or maybe middle-aged males. Well, there are a lot of mass shooters that fit that profile, but there are many others who don't. Even if they were all that, that still wouldn't tell you anything, because, you know, it's such a tiny subset of that demographic that commits this crime, that acts in this way, that that could never be predictive, right? The fundamental idea of the work being you're focusing on behaviors and circumstances, you're not going to be profiling people for who they are or what they like or what they look like, right? But there's also the question too of bias in terms of who becomes the subject of a threat case and the potential inequity there. A lot of sort of concern that I've seen raised about this field has been in the context of the so-called school to prison pipeline.
Yes.
Right. That you're gonna just go after kids that way, and that falls inordinately on Black and brown kids in schools. And that is true historically. That's a real problem. This is actually counter to that in what I've learned, when it's done effectively in the leading programs that I've studied in school systems, the intention of the behavioral threat assessment work was to reduce punitive measures for kids who are acting in ways that are disruptive or concerning. As I said at the outset, this isn't a punitive process. It's meant to be a constructive process, right? But it is a big challenge and a big question for this field to know more about that. And I think some leaders in the field are aware of it, and they're trying to develop more research now. And going forward, I think that would be key. If this is going to scale more nationally, there needs to be a rigorous study of that question, among others. Is this a fair and equitable process? There is some initial research showing that it is good in terms of outcomes, case outcomes, meaning threat assessment cases don't impact any specific demographic group of kids more than any others, where that has been studied. But it's limited, that research, to date, as far as I know.
What about with adults? Because obviously you want to start early if you can, but for the adults that are now past school and now they're in the workforce, I mean, you hear about the stereotype of the postman going crazy, for example, or in small companies, we've seen a lot of that, sometimes larger companies where there was a disgruntled former employee or current employee will then show up at work with a gun. How can we intervene there? What would that look like?
In some ways, fundamentally, it's more challenging because adults are less constrained structurally and programmatically in their work life, right? When you have a kid in school, there's a lot you can do to kind of control and monitor their environment. I mean, that sounds negative, but in the sense of like constructive help, it's really valuable. It's really good. In a workplace, the principles are the same. If someone in a workplace is acting in ways that is causing concern or anxiety in people around them, then a threat assessment team in that company is going to be asking the question, well, why is that happening? What's going on here? It does afford the same kind of approach, right? That you would be trying to figure out what is causing this person to raise alarm. What else do we know about their circumstance? Are they acting in ways that are threatening or communicating threats? And if so, what's our plan to manage it? It's challenging, right? There are different kinds of challenges. If you can look at some recent mass shooting cases where people were fired from jobs and then came back and committed a massacre. So it speaks to HR policy and personnel policy in important ways. How do you handle someone in a situation like that in a way that is going to give you the best possible outcome? And so that's how I think threat assessment tends to think about the method more in that context in a workplace situation.
Would you say that every organization, whether large or small, should have a threat assessment team? I mean, I'm imagining like mom and pop shops or small nonprofits in addition to the large companies.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard to say. Obviously, I think it's more difficult for a small company or a small family business to kind of devote resources or get training in this. But another sort of interesting question and kind of leading edge area of this field is how do you extend this into communities?
Yes.
And there are examples of that. One of the places where I spent a lot of time researching trigger points is Salem, Oregon. They were one of the first places to have a school system with a threat assessment model in the Salem-Keizer district there. They were one of the pioneers of this. But another innovation in that community is that they also have a what they call an adult threat advisory team. It's essentially a team for the adult community. And those two teams work together. They have overlapping membership. The history of that too is interesting. I'll just tell you briefly, it came out of, there was kind of a rash of threats against local judges in that community and some school leaders too, back in the late 1990s when they were starting to develop this model. Then Columbine happened. So the school was developing a model and they sort of realized through the overlap of mental health and criminal justice and police in the community, hey, we need to work more together. What that created was the ability for them to share information with each other about concerning individuals. So there's a case I write about in the book where there was a high school kid that was a very serious case, a kid who was threatening to bring a gun to school and then tried to commit suicide with an overdose. This was one of the first cases the team handled. They intervened and gave him a lot of help, and it was very successful. They were able to get him on a much better path. He went on to graduate a year and a half later, but then he was going out into the community. And the question was, well, what do you do now, right? He's no longer under the watch of a school threat assessment program. So they're able to say to their partners on the local adult team, okay, we want you to keep an eye on Eric and we'll talk more and we'll continue to help him. And that continued to be successful as well. You know, this speaks to how this could work in businesses as well, or perhaps in a community where a business isn't able to do this themselves, but they may be aware that it's available in the community.
So it sounds like there needs to be, as you said, research and then advocacy to get funding for these sorts of programs.
Yeah. Really, ultimately, this is a community-based prevention model. To the extent that that can be a very effective solution to violence, I think we could be doing more of it.
I'd like to take us back to kids because, sure, as I said, my son is 13 and you have kids yourself. What do we say to our kids about mass shootings? Because I've heard stories from my son talking about the active shooter drills that they've done in school and how disturbing that those are. Yeah. Is that the right approach, or should we be doing something else with our kids to prepare them for a possible mass shooting, which, as you said, is extremely unlikely?
Right. Statistically, it's not going to happen in most places. And yet, it's this very outsized problem in our society. It keeps happening, and we're all reacting to it in these ways, including these lockdown drills that are now ubiquitous in schools. For me, that was one of the real inspirations of writing Trigger Points, was focusing on this prevention model that is a way for us to think about this much differently, that we don't need to be scared of active shooters coming in and be reactive in that way if we have a proactive approach to dealing with problems within a community, right? Or there would certainly be less concern, I think, if people knew that. And meanwhile, these, you know, drills affect kids in ways that we now know are not positive. Yeah. They cause anxiety and depression. There's studies of that now. So when those were first becoming popularized a few years ago, I don't think anyone knew the answer to that at all. It was just accepted as a given that we would start doing this. But I don't discount that entirely, because there are reasons to prepare for disaster, however unpredictable or low probability they are. We do it with fires and tornadoes and earthquakes. There's a fundamental value in that. But I think we overly focus on it with this issue. The idea that we're going to have school kids all over the country practicing for when a shooter comes in seems a little bit crazy in some ways, when there's more we can be doing to mitigate that danger in the first place. So I think with talking to kids about it, it's more a matter of, I mean, of course, letting them know that this is something that's very rare, even though in the popular imagination and in the media, we tend to think this is happening all the time. That actually goes back to the definitional problem with mass shootings we discussed at the opening of the show. Yeah. You know, you see these headlines about how, like, oh, there's hundreds of mass shootings a year. And I frankly find that a very counterproductive way to talk about this problem. We have a bigger gun violence problem in the country that is referring to. And that's important too, but it's a different issue, right? In some ways. It's A, telling kids that schools are safe. By and large, schools are extremely safe. The chances of a student being killed in a school is like 1 in 2 million. It's infinitesimal, right? And then also talking about more of maybe of a culture of awareness. I mean, that's very important to this method of threat assessment. Most cases begin because someone in the community, what is referred to as a bystander, speaks up about something that they're worried about, something that's making them uncomfortable. A kid makes a comment about coming to school with a gun, and a peer who overhears them goes and tells a teacher because they're worried. There are several cases like that that I write about in the book, where that was the first in a chain of events that created a very important and effective intervention. Creating that sense of connectivity and culture of awareness is the way that kids really can learn about this more. And that's really what the field of threat assessment wants to have happen in schools in particular, because there are many cases where kids were aware of a school shooter coming in various forms and did not speak up. And it's very tragic. There are quite a lot of cases like that going back over the years, really quite astonishing. There's one took place in Alaska before Columbine, where a whole host of kids had heard that, you know, a kid was going to come to school and do something and maybe shoot up the school. And they all actually gathered on a mezzanine outside the library to watch.
What?
Yeah. You know, there's some very interesting kind of psychology and behavioral questions with kids. You know, often I think kids hear threats or see threatening things on social media nowadays in the context of school attacks, and they don't take them seriously. They think their peers are just joking. They can't really imagine someone doing this, even though we do have it in the news a lot. Yeah. So there's some important questions there too, in terms of creating the awareness among kids and the ability to intervene.
See something, say something, something like that.
Yes, that's right. It's very similar to that mantra that became nationalized after 9/11 a couple of decades ago. And it's a similar concept. Yeah.
Mark Fulman's new book is Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Follow him on Twitter at Mark Fulman. Mark, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's great talking with you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.